This is Monday, August 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Coming up, both the U.S. and North Korea have their say on the latest sanctions against Pyongyang.
For the time being, this problem is not going to be solved. It's a problem to be managed.
Also ahead, tensions rise as violence spread in Venezuela. And if you need a nap in Spain, we have the story of a place just for you. All on today's International Edition. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said Monday the best step North Korea could take to signal it's ready for dialogue would be to halt its missile test. He spoke from Manila, where he's taking part in the regional forum of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN. Tillerson said Saturday's U.N. Security Council vote unanimously adopting new sanctions against North Korea for its ballistic missile test sends a message that the entire international community finds the country's actions unacceptable, and that the clear expectation is a denuclearized Korean peninsula. North Korea denounced the sanctions today in a statement carried by state media, pledging to launch thousands-fold revenge on the U.S. and reiterating its stance that sanctions will not force it to negotiate over its nuclear program. North Korea said it will take action of justice, is what it called it, without elaborating, and said the U.S. would be making a mistake if it believed its mainland is safe because an ocean separates the two countries. We welcome to International Edition Mark Fitzpatrick. He is the Executive Director of IISS Americas, the International Institute for Strategic Studies. He also heads the IISS Non-Proliferation and Nuclear Policy Program. He's a former U.S. Foreign Service officer. Mark, thanks so much for being with us.
Sure, Ira.
Is there any difference that you can see so far between the Trump administration's policy toward North Korea, maybe the negotiations or the possible negotiations, and those of previous administrations?
No, there's not really much difference. There's some difference in terms of rhetoric, but there are no good policy options in dealing with North Korea. And the Trump administration has stuck to the same options that Obama and before him Bush and before him Clinton were pursuing, and that is a sanctions-focused policy while maintaining the prospect for engagement for a diplomatic solution if North Korea changes its behavior. And that's what the Trump administration has been saying.
In your view, is there any way or under what circumstances might the North Korean government change its stance or change its view?
I am very pessimistic about any basic change of attitude by the North Koreans. I mean, there is a hope that if faced with a stark choice between nuclear weapons and an economy, that they would choose the economy. But this is a country that allowed up to 2 million of its people to starve in the 1990s rather than accept the transparency associated with food aid. So I've concluded reluctantly that as long as there is a North Korea, it is going to cling to its nuclear weapons. And so the solution ultimately is a reunification of the Korean Peninsula. I'm not saying that the United States should or anyone else should invade North Korea and topple the regime. Regime change has to come organically from within. But the United States and its partners can make efforts to get information into the hands of North Korean citizens and let them draw their own conclusions about the destructive, corruptive nature of their leadership.
So am I reading this wrong, that you see the only way for this to be solved is through an internal rebellion among North Korean citizens?
That you put it pretty starkly. That's more or less what I was saying, but let me just make it clear that for the time being, this problem is not going to be solved. It's a problem to be managed, like the United States has managed many other problems. The United States was very concerned about China getting nuclear weapons and wondered how we could live with a nuclear-armed red China. Well, we did, and China, it does not create a sense of great doom in the United States, even though it has weapons that could hit any American city. So I think we can manage the North Korean problem, but ultimately I do believe that unification is the answer. And it may not be a rebellion by its citizens. There may be other means of changing the system. Sometimes systems are changed by a military coup, for example. This could all be very bloody, and there's a lot of danger associated with a change of regime. But just ultimately, I'm saying that North Korea is probably not going to give up its nuclear weapons as long as the regime clings to power.
But in contrast to what you described as what happened in China, is there a realistic chance that North Korea could or would and would launch a missile across the ocean and hit part of the United States?
Oh, there's it's very hard to see how North Korea would do something that would be so suicidal, because the United States has so many ways of responding that would immediately obliterate the North Korean regime, and they know that. The difficulty is that North Korea might launch a missile against a U.S. military base in Japan or in South Korea as an act of self-perceived self-defense if it thought that it was under attack. If it thought that the United States was about to launch a regime change invasion, or if the United States were to knock out one of its missiles and North Koreans thought that this was the first salvo in an invasion, then it might well respond with nuclear weapons. I can't see them doing that by sending an ICBM that probably wouldn't work because it's still very much in the initial developmental stage. But they have missiles that work very well that can range U.S. bases in Japan and South Korea. And that's the more likely scenario for North Korea lashing out.
Our thanks to Mark Fitzpatrick. He is the executive director of the International Institute for Strategic Studies, the Americas office here in Washington. Thanks, Mark.
You're welcome. Happy to talk to you.
We continue on International Edition with Andrew Palshevsky. He's checking social media, and President Trump was at the Twitter table again this morning, eh?
Yes, President Trump is on vacation up at his golf course in New Jersey, and there was some speculation that that might quiet down his Twitter activity being on vacation.
Somehow not.
Somehow not. A series of tweets this morning. He goes after Connecticut Senator Richard Blumenthal after Blumenthal appears on CNN to talk about the White House crackdown on leaks, and it's a series of rather long tweets, but he calls Blumenthal a Vietnam con artist. Of course, Blumenthal had served in the war in Vietnam. He degrades his military service, talks about how he lied because of this. Now, this is very interesting because Trump has gone after military service before. Of course, during the campaign, said that John McCain wasn't a war hero, had the run-in with the Khan family, whose son died in Iraq after they spoke against President Trump, then-candidate Trump, during the Democratic convention. But it's also interesting that he's doing this while General John Kelly, the retired general, is his chief of staff.
And thought he had put a cap on it. Huh?
Yes. Well, yeah. There was speculation that Kelly might try to rein in Trump's tweeting, but also the fact that Kelly is a former member of the military, former general. A lot of people very surprised that Trump would go after a military service like this. And today is hashtag Purple Heart Day, which is a day to honor the men and women in the military who have received a Purple Heart for being wounded or killed in service to the country. So a lot of people saying it's poor timing on the president's part to talk about a war veteran in this way on Purple Heart Day.
But, you know, the president has always said he is talking directly to his base, the people who support him, and he's going to continue to do it.
Yes, and he's enlisting his family now. His daughter-in-law, Lara Trump, has a new series of Real News videos on Facebook where she's talking about the real news about the president that isn't being covered. The first in that series already getting 2.3 million views on Facebook. So not just on Twitter, on Facebook, too.
Andrew Palshevsky with a look at social media here on International Edition. Among the top stories in the world, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson says the best step North Korea could take to signal it's ready for dialogue would be to halt its missile test. President Trump claimed Monday that his political base of Republican support is far bigger and stronger than ever before, despite new polling that shows it eroding. The U.S., Japan, and Australia expressed serious concerns over disputes concerning the South China Sea. And in one of the most closely watched electoral races on the African continent, Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta will face off tomorrow against longtime rival Raila Odinga. The race is projected to be tight. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
New findings from Ellen Boss, a scientist from the Carnegie Institution for Science, seems to back a long-held theory that the process that formed our solar system was set off by a shockwave from a supernova. A recent analysis of ancient meteorite samples shows an excess of the isotope nickel-60, which scientists say is formed from the decay of iron-60, a radioactive, short-lived isotope. This isotope, they say, is only created in large amounts by nuclear reactions inside certain kinds of stars, including supernovae. Boss tied the analysis with his computational model of a shockwave-generated cloud collapse and into the intermediate stages of the sun's formation. He says his findings suggest that a supernova shockwave is the most plausible origin story for explaining the existence of iron-60 isotopes in our solar system. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro said yesterday that his armed forces crushed a brief attack on a military base led by a rebellious former army officer. Maduro declared the attack was an act of terrorism financed by the United States and Colombia, but he gave no evidence for that claim in a regular Sunday evening TV broadcast. At least two of the intruders were killed during the firefight early Sunday with military units that overwhelmed the rebels at a base near the city of Valencia in central Venezuela. Joining us on the line from New York City is VOA correspondent Celia Mendoza. She has just returned from the Venezuelan border area. Celia, thanks for being with us. Just overall, how tenuous is this situation in Venezuela? Should we expect any further violence?
Thank you for having me. And yes, what we have seen in the past few days is an increase in tension and uncertainty in the part of the opposition of what they're going to do. And we saw this weekend was a lot of misinformation, a lot of conflicted accounts of what happened in Valencia, but it's evidence also of the tension between the military, the government of Venezuela, and the people of Venezuela, which at this point continue in the streets protesting for over 3 months. The opposition is trying to keep the resistance in peaceful protest. However, we have seen in the past few weeks an increase in violence by factions of the opposition, called specifically the resistance groups that are a little bit more violent, groups that had actually used explosives against the military. We saw it during the July 30th election day of the members of the Constitutional Assembly. We had an explosion in Caracas that was actually recorded by our cameras to our VOA reporter in Caracas, and that is evidence of the tension. Definitely something is going on in terms of the structure of the opposition. However, the leaders of the opposition have called for peaceful protests, for dialogue, to try to resist this new move by the government, but what is happening in the street is very scary for Venezuelans who don't know what's going to lead to.
How would you describe the current relationship between Caracas and Washington?
Very tense and a very, very dangerous point. We know that as the new chief of staff is coming into the White House, that has given a little bit of breathing space between the decisions that were made in the past few days. Washington was very clear that they are not going to leave the Venezuelan people alone, but they are going to make sure that they will sanction those that are committing crimes against others, and in this case in particular, the Venezuelan people. That's how come they are calling Nicolas Maduro a dictator. They are imposing sanctions against a lot of the leaders of the regime, as they call it, but it's also sanctions directly against Nicolas Maduro. And the possibility of sanctions against the oil sector is something that is very daunting for Venezuela, but especially for the Venezuelan people, members of the opposition, which actually live in the United States as refugees. They have said that that decision will actually end up hurting more the people of Venezuela who don't have any food, that they don't have any access to medicines, and the fact that the government of the United States might impose oil sanctions it will definitely hurt even more the people of Venezuela, and that is something that they don't want to see.
Well, what is life like for the average citizen of Venezuela now? How much different is it? I've heard stories of people digging through trash piles to try to find food.
And that's exactly what is happening in Venezuela. I was just in the border between El Táchira and Cúcuta in Colombia, and we spoke to several people. They all said exactly the same. People are losing weight at an incredible rate. The amount of people that are not being able to have even a meal a day or two meals a day. The fact that kids don't have milk for their bottles. It's something that every day increases even more. Colombia is receiving a large amount of Venezuelans coming looking for health services. The hospitals in Colombia, public hospitals, are ordered by the government of Colombia to actually attend Venezuelans without any sort of insurance or payment if they arrive there.
Is there any light at the end of this tunnel? You see any way out?
Well, the international community, the United Nations, the Organization of American States are pushing for dialogue. Try to get to a point where we will have a table where the opposition and the government can sit down and reestablish democracy. At this point, it's very hard to see that happening. The institution of this group of members that want to rewrite the constitution of Venezuela will provide a path, according to all the experts that have followed this crisis over the past few years, as the way for Nicolas Maduro to establish a dictatorship. And that's why the Vatican and the government of the United States, as well as other governments in the region, have pushed and pressured for a dialogue to try to get to the table, to try to reestablish the basic services to the people. In this crisis, it has gone from a political crisis to a humanitarian crisis.
VOA correspondent Celia Mendoza, she just returned from the Venezuelan border area and is joining us from New York City. Celia, thanks so much. This is VOA.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show. VOA.
We are always glad to have our listeners throughout Africa tuning in to our newscast covering Africa news. Tune in on the top of each hour 24/7. VOA is your trusted source of news and information.
We continue on International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. A midday nap is very much part of the Spanish traditional lifestyle. However, having a public place in which to take a nap is new. Siesta and Go is the first nap bar in Madrid, following in the bedroom slippers of similar services in London, Brussels, Tokyo, and other cities. As Faiza El-Masri tells us, workers at the nap bar hope the business will succeed in improving customers' health and professional performance. More from VOA's Faith Lapidus.
In Madrid nowadays, when people feel tired or sleepy in the afternoon, instead of sitting or lying down in a shady spot, they can head to the Siesta and Go bar and take a nap. Located in the city's bustling financial and commercial heart, the nap bar is open between 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. With 19 beds to rent by the minute or the hour, customers can choose a private or a shared room. An hour in a private room costs about $15. The bar also offers workspace and armchairs for customers who just want to relax or read a book in peace.
Well, I have always a long way from home and to my workplace. Yeah. So every day I feel very tired. So siesta is a special way for me to get some energy back.
Siesta and Go provides clean nightshirts, bed sheets, blankets, and comfortable pillows. They also offer customers coffee, Wi-Fi, newspapers, and slippers. Nappers don't need to worry about oversleeping, as employees gently wake the customer up at the agreed-upon time. Like many customers, Philip Marco finds a short nap refreshing and energizing.
I come for about 30 minutes, something like that. Sleep 30 minutes, and that usually is enough for me to be able to get through the evening.
But for some Spaniards, going to a nap bar is just not practical.
It's a Spanish tradition, but I think that it's more of a legend than a tradition, because with the lifestyle we have, the working hours, the rhythm of life that all Spanish workers ultimately have, you have very little free time for a siesta, in my case, at least during the week.
Yet health experts still recommend finding a way to squeeze a short nap into a busy work schedule.
Power napping is often referred to as the most powerful natural performance enhancer. This is because we know it increases energy levels, memory recall, motivation levels, and crucially attention and focus. And actually we've seen that you can double an individual's ability to solve a creative problem after a power nap than if they haven't.
In spite of the hectic city life, or maybe because of it, nap proponents hope the Siesta and Go bar will promote the benefits of napping and help more people enjoy a midday siesta. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
You ready for that nap? I am. You've been listening to International Edition. Find us at voanews.com. Like us on Facebook at VOA Now. Follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to our director, Kwame Ofori, our engineer, Dan Crafton. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Have a wonderful day or night.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
50 years ago today, five Asian countries seeking stability, security, and prosperity through closer cooperation banded together to form the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN. The governments of the five ASEAN founding countries, Indonesia, Malaysia, the Philippines, Singapore, and Thailand, sought to bring peace and stability to a developing region that was still recovering from the effects of colonialism and buffeted by the Cold War. Its model was a success, and by the end of the century, ASEAN had accepted five more nations for full membership: Brunei Darussalam, Vietnam, Laos, Burma, and Cambodia, and granted observer status to several potential members, as well as to numerous interested Asia-Pacific nations. ASEAN brings together some 635 million people. It encompasses a strategically important area of enormous cultural, linguistic, and ethnic diversity. ASEAN helps overcome many of these differences by providing a forum where the nations of Southeast Asia and beyond can resolve differences and work together to find common ground. Amidst enormous economic dynamism, ASEAN also sets unified standards and conformance measures, covering everything from military hardware to harmonization of services and transportation. This removes barriers to trade and promotes economic integration. No small thanks to this policy, in 2015, the gross domestic product of the ASEAN countries was around $2.8 trillion. ASEAN also amplifies the voice of its member states, allowing them to shape economic, political, and security trends in the Asia-Pacific region and beyond to a much greater degree than its members could achieve individually. Its convening power brings together all countries with a stake in the region to blaze a path toward cooperation on issues for which consensus does not yet exist. Over the half-century of its existence, ASEAN has built a reputation of promoting goodwill and diplomacy among nations. Its foundational principles of the rule of law, the equal rights of states, and the rejection of coercion remain essential to its success and support a rules-based order from which all nations, large and small, benefit. With these guiding lights, the future is bright for ASEAN.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.